Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 27th. I'm Bill Murphy here with Chris Sports. And everything, of course, is UConn. So we will start with the men. I have a couple stories and one on the women. Take us probably through the first half of the broadcast. It was April 6, 1992, and Bobby Hurley was at the center of blue and white maze of euphoria. CBS cameras rolling as Christian Laettner, Grant Hill, and a gaggle of teammates, cheerleaders, and the Duke mascot surrounded him, celebrating this once-in-a-lifetime accomplishment. Duke had just defeated Chris Webber, Juwan Howard, and the Michigan Wolverines 71-51 to win its second straight national title, the first men's college basketball team to capture consecutive championships since John Wooden's UCLA dynasty won seven straight from 1967 to 1973. Hurley, who averaged 13.9 points and 7.8 assists per game in the tournament, was named Final Four Most Outstanding Player. It was the sixth time in 7 years since middle school his team had finished its season by cutting down the nets. His younger brother Dan was a freshman at Seton Hall that year, averaging 2.8 points, 0.9 assists, 0.5 steals in 11 minutes per game. His team, the Big East regular season champions, had been sent home by the Blue Devils in the Sweet 16, a game in which Dan saw 10 minutes of action and didn't score. If anyone outside of Big East country knew about Dan back then, it was only because of his last name. It would have been nearly impossible to imagine Dan equaling his brother's college basketball championship total then, but now, 32 years later, the younger Hurley is four wins away from celebrating his own once-in-a-lifetime accomplishment. If UConn does what oddsmakers and a majority of bracket filler outers expect and wins a second straight title, it would become just the second program since Bobby Hurley's 1991 and 1992 Duke squads to do it, and the seventh all-time. It would entrench the Hurley family name, already synonymous with success, even further into college basketball lore. It would be four championships in our family name in the last 32 years, which is nuts, Bobby Hurley told The Current in a phone interview. It's kind of crazy to think about that. Bobby Hurley was, of course, a prodigy as a player, a standout at St. Anthony High School in Jersey City, New Jersey, where his father Bob was a Hall of Fame coach and point guard on teams that won four straight state titles and earned the number one high school ranking in the country. Not only was he a McDonald's All-American, he was co-MVP of the 1989 McDonald's All-American game with Shaquille O'Neal. He was the definition of a five-star blue-chip prospect, a household name. You could have forgiven Dan for being envious of his brother's playing career, and even though a motorcycle accident in 1993 derailed Bobby's dream of NBA stardom, he's remembered as a college basketball legend. Dan, 2 years younger, wound up carving out a nice college career at Seton Hall, averaging 14.3 points and 5.2 assists in his senior year, but didn't sniff the NBA. Instead, he got right into coaching. Bobby, now head coach at Arizona State, believes that has given his brother an edge on the competition. I think he's got natural instincts he's developed since he was a little kid being around the game his whole life. He's been doing this so long that the decisions you have to make as a head coach are very natural to him, Hurley said. He's highly competitive, he cares about his players, and he's been able to really develop as a coach and maximize what he can get out of his players. Bobby's playing career came to an end in 1999 as long-term effects from the accident limited his impact on the floor. He spent some time away from basketball getting into horse racing and returning briefly as a scout for the Philadelphia 76ers in 2003. It wasn't until Dan got the job at Wagner College in 2010 and convinced him to join his staff that he rediscovered his love for the game and caught the coaching bug. The two immediately helped turn Wagner around, taking the program from 5-26 the year before they arrived to 25-6 in year two. After moving with Dan to the University of Rhode Island in 2012, Bobby was hired as head coach at the University at Buffalo in 2013. In 2015, he had the Bulls in the NCAA tournament for the first time. Power conference programs came calling, and Bobby was hired at Arizona State that offseason. He's been there ever since, though he's yet to lead the Sun Devils past the round of 64 in three tournament appearances. Dan, of course, kept his head down and slowly built Rhode Island into a mid-major powerhouse. He earned the UConn job after taking the Rams to the round of 32 in the NCAA tournament in back-to-back years in 2017 and 18, even sending home Trey Young in Oklahoma in his penultimate game at URI. After years of watching Bobby have so much success, Dan has grabbed the college basketball world by the scruff of the neck over the last two seasons, to the point where San Diego State head coach Brian Dutcher referred to the regionals in Boston as the, quote, UConn Invitational, unquote. Asked to compare the Huskies with his still-revered Blue Devils teams, Bobby sees some common threads. It's eerily similar to my situation. The first year might have been a little unexpected for us to win it. In the second year, though, we were one of the favorites playing with a lot of confidence, and that's what I've seen most of the year from this UConn team. He also sees some similarities between his brother and Mike Krasinski. Coach K, we loved him. We'd run through a wall for Coach K, and he had tremendous belief in us, too, which gave you great confidence because you knew that he trusted you. And I feel like most likely that's how most of the UConn team feels about Dan. They know he's all in and invested in them and that he's a fighter and a competitor and he wants these types of games. If the Huskies are able to become the seventh program to win back-to-back titles, it could put Dan on the doorstep of the Basketball Hall of Fame where he'd join his father. Five of the six coaches who have won consecutive championships are also in the hall, with Cincinnati's Ed Jucker the only outlier. It's a short distance from two titles to Springfield. The enormity of it all isn't lost on Bobby, and it's clear there's no one out there rooting harder for Dan than him. It's so satisfying to just watch him cut the nets down and to see the run he's been on, Hurley said. I'd just be really happy for Dan. I know how hard he works. I know what he puts into what he does. So I hope he can do it again. And another story on UConn men. By the way, they'll be playing San Diego State at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday. That'll be on TBS TV. Now here's the other story on the men. Questions posed to the UConn men Sunday night in their latest locker room celebration range from references to shipping up to Boston to requests to try their hand at a Boston accent. Not many takers. Players seemed unfamiliar with the Dropkick Murphys' thunderous recording, and they waited until Tuesday when Jim Calhoun addressed the team in practice to become reacquainted with an authentic Boston accent. Though UConn Nation theoretically stretches that far, its eyes have long been trained to look south toward New York. References toward New York, references to New York is soar south, of course, as stores as the sixth borough have made the internet rounds for years. Perhaps the best-known UConn fan in Boston is a fictional character, Rebecca Howe, played by Christy Alley in the 1980 sitcom Cheers. Now the Huskies will be playing in TD Garden, the historical successor to the famed Boston Garden, home of the Celtics, for the East Regionals, starting with round of 16 game against San Diego on Thursday, 7:30 p.m., as I mentioned. Here's a chance to extend its brand to the North and East. By Sunday, if UConn is playing in the Elite Eight against Illinois or Iowa State, maybe they could start calling it Stono. I think we're going to have some really, really insane UConn crowds, Coach Dan Hurley said. I think it's going to be much louder than it was here. I get the feeling that a lot of our fans just assume that we'd get out of Brooklyn and will be waiting for us in Boston. Historically, many of UConn's signature moments have come in New York City's Madison Square Garden, in the Big East NIT and NCAA tournaments, where they upset Iowa State and Michigan State in the way to the 2014 title. This month, the Huskies won the Big East tournament there and the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Huskies fans in Boston have actually been waiting a long time for an opportunity such as this. UConn has played hockey and football at Fenway Park, but more recently than the men's basketball team has appeared at the TD Garden. But UConn's roots up through New England go back further, to the days when the Yankee Conference and the ECAC created rivalries with the schools in the Boston area. From Northeastern, UConn lured Calhoun, native Bostonian, in 1986 to come and build the program into what it is today. "We're trying like crazy not to be that small town between New York and Boston," Calhoun said. "This is another chance to show we're the place where the best basketball is. The minute we get on that floor, they'll see it. For us who grew up there, it's a special place." Among well-known UConn names, Carl Hobbs came from Boston, as did Chavez Napier, D. Rowe from Worcester, Mass., and Toby Kimball from Framingham. Current standout Alex Carabon is from Southborough, 28 miles to the west. Though UConn recruits nationally and often emphasizes the New York to Philadelphia corridor, where Hurley and Kamani Young have ties, assistant Tom Moore, a Boston University grad from Millbury, Mass., keeps the pipeline to New England open. But the Huskies have had few occasions to play in the main Boston areas. UConn last played at TD Garden on December 2nd, 2007, a non-conference game against Gonzaga billed as the Hartford Hall of Fame showcase before about 18,000. The Zags won that in a close game. Boston College hosted UConn in the old Boston Garden on January 27, 1987, a notable game during Calhoun's first season. The Huskies lost two of their top players, Phil Gamble and Cliff Robinson, to academic ineligibility, but pulled what at the time was a big upset, a first sign of turning the corner. Between 1976 and 79, an event known as the Colonial Classic was staged at the Old Garden, meant to be a basketball version of college hockey's Beanpot, and UConn was invited to play in 1978 and 79. The Huskies lost to Holy Cross and Boston College in 78, defeated Holy Cross despite 46 points from Ronnie Perry, then lost to BC in 79, and the event didn't draw well. And though records are spotty with regards to venues, that appears to be the extent of UConn's history in the Boston Garden, which was open for business from 1928 to 1998, the Fleet Center and TD Garden. Holy Cross played home games there in the 1940s, but UConn did not play them. The Huskies did play Holy Cross at Boston Arena, now Matthews Arena, at Northeastern in February 1952, and the other Boston teams at campus arenas. But Boston, traditionally considered a pro sports town, has rarely been home to major college basketball events, nor gone wild over them. "When I was at Northeastern," Calhoun said, "the joke was that Rick Pitino at Boston University and I hated each other because we were fighting to be number 9 in an 8-team town." As fans made their way to Boston via the Mass Pike or Amtrak, one solid block of Boston fans will be coming from nearby Southborough. Carabon saw a lot of Celtics games there and has had success on its iconic parquet floor, a feature from the original garden. "When I was at Algonquin, I played a high school game there, and we won AAU-wise. We won games there, too," Carabon said. "I haven't lost a game at TD Garden yet. Knock on wood. It's definitely a special place. I wouldn't want to be there with any other guys. Just to have two opportunities to play in TD Garden will be special." And I'm going to try to get this story in before the weather as much as I can. Less than 24 hours after leading the UConn women's basketball team to a 30 consecutive Sweet 16 appearance, superstar guard Paige Beckers was named a finalist for the Naismith Player of the Year on Tuesday for the second time in her career. Beckers, a redshirt junior, became the first freshman ever to win the Naismith Trophy in 2021, but her sophomore and junior seasons were marred by injury. She missed 19 games in 2021-22 to undergo surgery on a tibial plateau fracture and returned for in postseason to lead UConn to the NCAA championship game, then sat out all of 2022-23 with a torn ACL. The Husky Sires made a remarkable comeback in 2023-24, earning Big East Player of the Year and unanimous first-team All-American honors. She won the Nancy Liberman Award for the nation's best point guard in 2021, but a plague of injuries on UConn's roster forced her to play most of her minutes out of position this season. She still is a finalist for the Ann Myers Drysdale Award, given to the top shooting guard in the country, and she made the 15-player national ballot for the Wooden Award. We're going to go to the weather now. I'll be back with more sports after that.
Chris is now playing on TuneIn. Download the app today or listen to us on your Amazon Echo or Google Home.
The forecast for tonight has rain likely, otherwise cloudy, with a low around 46. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Tomorrow, Thursday, rain is likely, otherwise cloudy, with a high near 52. Chance of precipitation is 60%. And tomorrow night, rain is likely, it'll be cloudy, with a low around 37. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Friday, there's a slight chance of rain, partly sunny, with a high near 50. Chance of precipitation is 20%. And Friday night will be partly cloudy, with a low around 35. Saturday will be sunny, with a high near 54. And Saturday night, mostly cloudy, with a low around 36. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
Now on to the women. Noblesville, Indiana is basketball country, smack dab in the middle of a candy stripe state that lives and dies by the Indiana Hoosiers every March. Ashlyn Shade was raised on the NCAA tournament, spending countless hours imagining herself on the other side of the television screens that her family congregated around each year. Matt Shade thought he knew what to expect when he took his seat behind the UConn women's basketball bench to watch his daughter in Monday's second-round tournament matchup with Syracuse. But the sold-out crowd at Campbell Pavilion exceeded everything he imagined from the basketball capital of the world as the Huskies advanced to the Sweet 16 with a 72-64 win. "This place is crazy. It's like on steroids," Matt said. "I mean, this is basketball at the highest level. March Madness is such a big part of our whole lives. So just to see your daughter out there and to see them perform and then move on, it's like surreal. It's definitely different watching now, though. A lot more stressful." Ashlyn, too, exceeded every expectation in her March Madness debut. The freshman put up a career-high 26 points, plus 6 rebounds and 2 steals in UConn's first-round win over number 14 seed Jackson State, then doubled down with 19 points, 4 rebounds, and 2 steals against the Orange on Monday. She averaged 54.8% shooting from the field and 50% from three-point range across 2 games, playing 79 of a possible 80 minutes. "As unreal as it often feels in the moment, none of it surprises Matt. All the work that's done behind the scenes in the gym, I've seen the practices, the AAU games, she's prepared, and this is the stage," he said. "This is why she came to UConn." Matt started envisioning Ashlyn in a UConn jersey when she was in fourth grade, nearly a decade before she would accept a scholarship offer from Gino Auriemma as the number 15 prospect in the class of 2023. Even at 9 years old, Matt saw the foundations of an elite athlete: hand-eye coordination, balance, court visions. He immediately thought that UConn, then in the midst of its record-shattering 111-game win streak, could be the perfect program someday for his young daughter. "I kind of knew she was going to UConn, and I've watched Gino forever," Matt said. "She's skilled, she's coachable, and she's a team player. That's what UConn basketball is, so it made total sense. But until you're in that practice gym and live through it, it's different." Ashlyn's first year in Soars hasn't gone the way Matt or anyone expected from the very first game of the year. The whole Shade family, Matt, Ashlyn's mom Casey, and twin brother Jack, all flew down to Raleigh to watch UConn's season opener against North Carolina State. The Huskies lost 92-81 to the then-unranked Wolfpack, and Ashlyn never even took her warm-ups off. "There were tears afterward," Matt said, "and it wouldn't be the last time." Minutes quickly became the least of Ashlyn's concerns, though as season-ending injuries decimated UConn's roster, she was thrust into her first career start just 2 weeks after spending the whole game on the bench in North Carolina and became a fixture in the lineup alongside fellow freshman K.K. Arnold after starting against Ball State on December 6th. We knew that this might be preparation, but when she didn't get in at all, we were like, oh no, like this is going to be a rough one, Matt said now with a rueful smile. There was a lot of tears, but then opportunity arose and she never quit. Ashlyn never quits. She grinds and has grit, so she's always going to be ready, but that definitely was a defining moment. REM is in famously brash style, also required an adjustment period for Ashlyn, a people pleaser to her core. She was desperate to make a good impression on the legendary Huskies coach, and she internalized every critique he hollered at her during practice. Oriema often lamented earlier in the year that Shade cared too much about what he thought. I just put too much pressure on myself, and you can't put pressure on yourself or you're going to explode, Shade said. He's not going to change. He's even told me. I've probably already yelled at you 5 times, so just expect that. It's going to happen, and there's nothing you can do about it, so don't even worry about it. I had to retrain my mind, so when I hear those things, I don't get negative on myself and redirect that into more of a positive thing mentally for me. Ashlyn's transition into the starting lineup on the court was overwhelmingly smooth. She was named Big East Freshman of the Week 5 times, scoring at least 12 points in 9 of the Huskies' first 10 conference games. But she hit a point in the season, or Emma said most freshmen run into when things are just moving too fast. Her production remained solid, but Ashlyn's efficiency suffered. She hit a 3-point shooting slump after going 2-for-11 against number 1 South Carolina, and every clank off the rim also put another dent in her already fragile confidence. We were talking with the strength and conditioning coaches, and we got to a point where we said she has no legs. She's played so many minutes and totally unanticipated, Oriema said. You could see, like, every shot was short. I told her you have to get out of the gym, let the ball feel good again. The ball was feeling heavy and sluggish, and at some point she got her second wind. And I'm going to stop there because I want to cover a little bit of baseball. I do have one more story on UConn senior guard Nika Mule. She got 2 texts before Monday's NCAA tournament second-round game against Syracuse. One was from Moriah Jefferson wishing her luck on breaking Jefferson's all-time assist record at UConn. Oh, my God, I hadn't even broken it yet, Mule said. She's just a legend. I was not expecting that message. I was so focused on the game. The other was from her dad. He told her, don't foul out. Mule broke the assist record on a pass to Ashlyn Shade for a 3-pointer with 1:56 left in the first quarter Monday night. She also fouled out with 5:17 left in the game in Syracuse pressing. Mule was the main defender on Syracuse's fifth-year Diasha Fair, the fifth-leading scorer in NCAA women's basketball history going into the game, and she was able to keep Fair under control much of the night. Once she left the game, her teammates took it to the rest of the way in third-seeded UConn's 72-64 victory over number 6-seeded Syracuse in front of a sellout crowd at Gamble Pavilion. Some calls maybe I wouldn't agree with, but I feel like I deserve to sit on the bench, Mule said. This is a lesson for me, but I'm so proud of my teammates and the way they stepped up for me. On Sunday, UConn coach Gino Auriemma said he would be happy if UConn held Fair, an explosive scorer, who averages 22 points to under 20. Fair had exactly 20 points, 9 in the fourth quarter, on 6-for-22 shooting. Freshman K.K. Arnold and senior guard Paige Beckers also took turns guarding Fair, who passed Southwest Missouri State's Jackie Stiles at 3,393 and Ohio State's Kelsey Mitchell, 3,402, to end her career with 3,403 points. She's a great player, and Nika did quite a lot to her following her around, making everything tough, Becker said. We knew ahead of a game she was going to hit tough shots. We had to try to limit her shots and her touches and make sure every shot she took was contested and try not to foul. Nika did a great job, but that's a really good player over there. And now on to baseball. Start with the Red Sox. The Red Sox made a stunning roster move late Monday night, announcing their left-hander Brennan Bernardino had been optioned to AAA following the club's exhibition win over the Texas Rangers. Bernardino was Boston's top left-hander throughout last season and one of the club's biggest recent success stories, and coming into camp, he was widely considered a lock to make the opening day roster. Originally claimed off waivers from Seattle last spring, Bernardino emerged as a key part of Boston's bullpen and as a stabilizing force when the club's other lefties were mostly hurt. Bernardino appeared in 55 games and posted a 3.20 ERA over 50.2 innings. And this spring, he posted a perfect 0.00 ERA in 7 Grapefruit League appearances. So why wouldn't Bernardino make the team? Red Sox manager Alex Cora told reporters following the game, the move was made to preserve roster flexibility, given that Bernardino has minor league options and can be moved up and down from AAA freely. The same can't be said for fellow left-hander Joey Rodriguez, who was added to the big league roster this past weekend, in part to keep him in the organization after he triggered an opt-out provision in his contract. And on to the Yankees. MLB schedule makers didn't do the Yankees any favors to start the 2024 season. The Yankees begin the year at their longtime House of Horrors in Houston, then travel farther west to face the reigning National League champion Arizona Diamondbacks and only get one day off in the first 2 weeks. It's an early test for a retooled Yankee team that enters the season with World Series aspirations but is battered and bruised following multiple key injuries during spring training. Gerrit Cole, last year's American League Cy Young Award winner, is set to begin the season on the injured list due to nerve irritation and edema in his throwing elbow, forcing the Yankees to navigate the March-April gauntlet without their steady innings-earning ace. Leadoff hitter DJ LeMahieu's opening day status remains unclear after a foul ball off his right foot left him with, as manager Aaron Boone described it, a pretty significant bone bruise. Aaron Judge says he'll be ready to go after going through an abdominal discomfort this month that cost him more than a week of spring training and put him behind schedule. A fast start would help the Yankees further distance themselves from last year's disappointing 82-80 campaign, but again, it won't be easy. Nestor Cortes is set to the opening day game on March 28th in Houston, where he's in line to face Astros lefty Framber Valdez. Cortes last pitched on August 5th, coincidentally against the Astros, before a rotator cuff strain ended his 2023 season early. And I'm just going to read a couple notes from the Mets. The 2024 schedule presents the Mets with prime opportunities to pick up some early wins, but gets much harder in a hurry. 4 of the Mets' first 5 opponents are projected to win fewer than 80 games, according to Baseball Prospectus PECOTA sabermetric system. First up are the depleted Milwaukee Brewers, who open the season with a 3-game series at Citi Field beginning on March 28th. The Brewers won 92 games in the National League Central last season, but traded away ace Corbin Burns in the offseason and are expected to be without fellow frontline starter Brandon Woodruff for most of, if not all, 2024 as he recovers from shoulder surgery. The Brew crew also lost President of Baseball Operations David Stearns to the Mets and manager Craig Counsell to the Chicago Cubs. Following the mass exodus, the Brewers are expected to win only 79 games in 2024, fewer than the Mets in 83. And one more note here. After hosting Milwaukee from March 28th to 31st with a March 29th off day, the Mets welcome the Detroit Tigers, who won 78 games last season but are projected for 3 fewer victories this year from April 1st to the 3rd. The Mets then embark on their first road trip with stops in Cincinnati April 5th to the 7th, in Atlanta, April 8th to the 11th. The up-and-coming Reds at 82-80 flirted with a wild card spot last season, but fell just short. And we don't have much on the air today. There's NIT action. That's UNLV at Seton Hall. That's the quarterfinal in St. Joseph, Missouri. That's on ESPN2. Another game, St. Joseph, Missouri, NIT tournament, VCU at Utah. In the NBA, there are two games, L.A. Clippers at the Philadelphia 76ers, that's on ESPN, and at 10.05 p.m. Phoenix at Denver, ESPN, and there is one NHL hockey game, that is the Boston Bruins at the Tampa Bay Lightning, at 7.30 p.m. on TNT. That's it for the sports for today. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.